the agenda is approval of the minutes from December 3rd. Do I have a motion?
So moved.
Second.
Madam Chairman, I have an amendment to make to the minutes.
Sure.
Ms. Clydie Miller DeBrew's name was misspelled, and I've given that information to our clerk. So I think rather than spelling it out here for everybody, just say that the amendment is to correct the spelling of Ms. DeBrew's name.
All right. All right. And do we have a second to that?
Second.
All right. All those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
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 All those in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
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 Our next item on the agenda is public comment. If you are here for public comment, please go up to the podium. You have 2 minutes to speak, and I'm setting my timer.
Good morning.
Morning.
George Freeman, 1450 Bowman Road, Director of Community Activity for CAGE. This is you have an annexation and a request to be added to the Sweetgrass Basket Overlay request coming up. This is very confusing to us as members of CAGE and to the members of the citizens of the 6 Mile community and 7 Mile community. Over 13 years ago, the county, the town of Mount Pleasant, and the citizens from the 6 Mile and 7 Mile community got together to try to solve a situation where developers were going to the town, to the county or to the town and say, if you don't give me what I want, I'm gonna go to the other one, and that's the sort of thing. So everybody got together to create an overlay to create a zoning for the area that would be in place for the county and for the town of Mount Pleasant. So there would be no confusion when somebody wanted to do something in the area that the county would respect it and the town of Mount Pleasant would respect it. It had been in place for almost 13 years. It's even in our comprehensive plan. But there's a certain area in the 6 Mile community where the citizens keep coming with requests to change from the zoning that is in place for the entire community. Now, in my understanding, majority rules. The majority has already stated what the zoning should be, but we keep getting requests to have it changed, and the only government that has violated this overlay is the town of Mount Pleasant. The county has not violated it since it's been in place for 13 years, and we have no longer have the situation where developers can come in and say, if you don't give me what I want, I'm going to go to the other. But I'm here today to ask you to put a stop to this, because there's a certain part of the 6 Mile community where those citizens do not want to follow the rules. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else here to speak?
Robert Timmerman, 2142 Golf Drive. I live on 6 Mile as well, lived there my entire life. 31 years of being in the same neighborhood, I've seen it come a long way. I bought that house when I was 18 years old. I bought my parents out of the place. And I'm one of those developers. I'm a third generation of residents of Mount Pleasant. My mom grew up in the old village, so did my grandfather. You know what I mean? I've seen this place grow into what it's been. Although the Sweetgrass Overlay District was voted in 13 years ago, what I've witnessed happened in my life since then is the older community that is no longer able to upkeep that, community leaders and such like that, don't come in to help these people clean up their properties. So it becomes blighted over time. I'm not saying that's always the case, but it does happen. And for instance, on Annie Lore Lane, where we're trying to do this proposed split and annexation and so on, you guys gave us, and I own the 12 lots at the end of Annie Lore Lane that this R3 zoning was granted. And the particular reason I did that is there was a fire that burnt down someone's garage. And they had to park in my front yard, run hoses through my garage to get the back of Annie Lore Lane. So we said, well, I'll gladly do this project and buy it and do it. But one of the requests was interconnectivity from Annie Lore to Golf Drive, and they wanted 3 fire hydrants. We gladly did that. Not only did we do that, we re-renovated the water system there, put new sidewalks and gutters in. We repaved the road all the way up to Golf Drive, all the way from Golf Drive all the way to 6 Mile. We put gas lines down there, mainly redid all the infrastructure on that road. I took out over 300 tons, and that's not an exaggeration, I have the receipts to prove it, of trash on this road from where the area became blighted. So my real question is although this overlay district is there, I'm concerned about what it's preserving now. I like the corridor because the baskets are still made.
Please start your comment.
Yes, ma'am. And so my question is, we have to be careful. I know it's the comment was made before about death by a thousand cuts, but what we have to be careful with now is, what are we actually preserving? Because these people that want to do something with their property for themselves and for their family, which is what this gentleman's trying to do, is build a house for himself and his son. I think we ought to take consideration of what we're actually trying to protect and what the original intent was.
Thank you much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here to speak public comment? Mr. Santos?
Gary Santos, 1690 Greystone Boulevard in Mount Pleasant. 13 years ago, I voted for the Sweetgrass Basket Overlay District, you know, to try and protect that area. Unfortunately, throughout the years, we've had some votes that have omitted or allowed folks to come out of it. Now we have hotels down in that area, and we have a lot of things that are going on that initially we did not want. That's why we decided to do the overlay district. So, you know, the zoning and all, that's one thing, but I think we ought to keep this in the Sweetgrass Basket Overlay District. I know George could probably fall out of his seat because it's the first time in 20 years we've agreed on something, but I think it's important, really, that we keep the integrity of the Sweetgrass Basket Overlay District the way it is now. Thanks.
Is there anyone else here to speak?
Yes, good morning, everyone. My name is Deborah Sanchez. I have been in this property since 1984. I was given this property by my husband's grandmother, which I had her first great-grandson. This was never, ever Sweetgrass Basket Weave Parkway or anything like that. This was privately owned land. I have paperwork where Mr. Wilkes, I believe his name was, during the summer, had just got his subdivided right near that one. So we're just asking for the same treatment that everybody else on this road has received. Thank you.
Is there anyone else? Mr. Rambo?
Jake Rambo, 428 Shannon Drive. I'm here to speak on item 5, which talks about potential revisions to the ordinance, which deal with non-conforming properties. I feel very strongly that hopefully Planning Committee will send this to full council for discussion, because as we talk about updates to the comprehensive plan, updates to the height map, things like that, I'm very wary of making changes that result in a bunch of non-conforming properties where a property owner has, you know, built a building or whatever that they had approval for, that if there's some catastrophic disaster, they all of a sudden cannot rebuild. So I know, talked with a couple of other council members, and I know that changing this language of this ordinance will make more people comfortable with changes to heights and zoning and that sort of thing. So thank you.
All right. Is there anyone else here who would like to make 2 minutes of public comment?
Hi, my name is Joseph Sanchez, property owner of 2160 Annie Laura Lane. As it goes to this Sweetgrass Overlook, I was never made aware of this project because we moved away for a number of years for work, moved back, and recently found out about this. I would have never agreed to this myself because another entity overseeing me and my property is just not what I want to be. This property has been developed over the years. My wife and my family have owned this property since 1984. We just want to develop like everyone else is in the area. As my wife said earlier, just this past June, a request to do the same thing we're doing was presented to this council and approved later on for the same thing. I see a lot of development in that area. The north side of Highway 6 Mile, it's completely different than what it was. It's been developed. I don't see nobody opposing it. There's no reason why this should be opposed. I don't infringe upon anybody else's rights, but this is my right, my wife's right, my family's right. We want to develop our lives. We should be given the opportunity to do this. There's nothing that should hold it back. The Sweetgrass Overlook, I've never got any benefits from it. Now I get heartache from it. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Is there anyone left who would like to speak? 2-minute public comment. Going once, going twice, and public comment is closed. On to item number 3 on the agenda, review of Planning Commission recommendations. Item 3A, Jeff or Michelle, take it away.
Thank you, ma'am. So this is a request to annex and zone a property at 2161 Annie Laura Lane. The first request before you is to actually annex this property. It's currently in the county. You can see it there right off of Annie Laura in 6 Mile. And it is zoned in the county currently as Mount Pleasant Overlay District. And I'm happy to answer questions regarding the annexation.
Is there any questions from?
For discussion, Madam Chairman, while I was on the Planning Commission, the end of Annie Laura Lane came to us, and it's been substantially improved, much better. This property looks to be a manufactured house still on the trailer that it's on. And I think we can do a lot to improve the area by taking this in and making it similar to what we did several years ago with the properties at the end of Annie Laura Lane. So I would like to make a motion that we approve the annexation request.
I second.
All right, we have a motion and a second. We're now open for discussion. I have a question.
Okay.
So the zoning you said under the county is Mount Pleasant Overlay?
Yeah.
What does this change fit within our comprehensive plan?
No, so our current comprehensive plan, as you can see, calls for community conservation. And the draft plan is very similar. You can tell actually the dark brown, those have all had a comprehensive plan amendment in the past to be changed to medium density resident or medium density neighborhood to allow for the R3 medium density residential zoning. The yellows are all still same future land use, which is community conservation. And the Sweetgrass Basket Overlay is not shown here, but it actually ends right across from the property with the star where you can see the blue public institutional land. That's the edge of the boundary of the Sweetgrass Basket Overlay. And so how it works is if you automatically annex in, you are assigned a zoning which is based on what the comprehensive plan calls for. So if the comprehensive plan calls for community conservation and you just come in with an annexation and you don't request a specific zoning, the community conservation is applied to you, but an overlay is not automatically applied. You have to request to be in it, otherwise you're not in it, and that's just how our zoning ordinance is written. And so what the request is before you today is not only to annex, but to come into the town and request R3, which is what all the brown properties are, and to not be in the overlay district, because the R3 zoning district and the overlay, Sweetgrass Basket Overlay, are directly in conflict. There's no reason to be in the overlay if you're going to have an R3 zoning, because the overlay would require you to have the CC underlying, because those are similar development standards, if that makes sense. So to request the R3 is essentially in line with requesting not to be in the overlay.
And how many houses could be built on that property under community conservation versus R3?
One under community conservation. So the development standards for CC, it requires 12,500 square feet, and minimum standards are 80 feet by 110 depth. For the R3, it's 6,000 square feet, and it's 50 by 70. And you can see with the development patterns there how it's been, it's come in, been rezoned to R3, and there have been subsequent subdivisions of land. But there could only be two, if they get the R3 zoning, there could only be two lots there. They couldn't accomplish any more than that.
All right. Does anyone have any further questions?
I would just suggest if you look at what's happening and what improvements have been made in that neighborhood, that this is consistent with what is happening and what's been previously approved, and I've just called for the question.
So we're talking about two houses, no more than two houses, right?
No more than two houses.
That's correct. All right. All those in favor, please say, did you have anything? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? No. Motion to send to full council, the recommendation is 3-1. All right, to number B?
Yeah.
3B?
Yeah, so 3B is just the request to zone it to R3, which would allow a subdivision of the property. It would allow the smaller lot size. And as you mentioned, there is currently a single-family residence there. So before a lot line, before a subdivision could occur and a lot line could be established, that would have to be removed, and it would have to go through the subdivision process, which would be approved by Planning Commission. But the request before you is to come in to zone R3 and to not be included in the Sweetgrass Basket Overlay District.
All right. Do we have a motion?
I'll move for approval and, again, call your attention to what's there now and what we're going to, I'm sure, get once this is approved.
All right. We have a motion. Do we have a second?
I second it.
All right. Is there any discussion?
Right. I'm just confused. So can you just repeat it one more time, please, just what the actual issue is?
Okay.
What I'm voting on?
So if they were not requesting the R3 zoning, they would automatically come in as community conservation.
Okay.
Which would be consistent with the comp plan, and it would allow for one lot there, the existing lot. It would have to be 12,500 square feet. Over the years, we've had lots come in and request a different zoning because they were a little bit larger lots. So if they rezoned to R3, that allows a smaller lot size.
Okay.
And so you can see the development patterns at the end of Annie Laura and then up at the beginning right off of 6 Mile, where you've had many of those lots up there were actually, they were aggregated. So the first two lots were actually like one lot. And so over the years, they have requested to come in, become R3 instead of the automatic CC, and not be in the overlay so that they could subdivide their property. Okay. And many of them, I know, are subdividing for a family member or something like that. And so what would happen, though, is if they were included in the Sweetgrass Basket Overlay District, the overlay district takes precedent over the underlying zoning. So if you were to come in and request R3, but then you were placed in the overlay district, you couldn't accomplish the R3 development. You would have to have the 12,500. So there would be no reason to request R3 if you were placed in the overlay.
And they are not?
They're currently not in the overlay. They have to request to be in it, and they are not requesting to be in it. They just want to come into the town, and they want to be straight R3, which is what all the other brown lots up there are.
And the people against it don't want them. They want them to be in the overlay district.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. The Sweetgrass Basket Overlay District, as was mentioned, has been in place for about 13 years, and there's been some dismantling of it with properties coming in and requesting to not be in it and then subdividing. And so over the years, there have been properties that have been taken out of it for development purposes. And so that's the concern in this area.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, so this lot with the star is 0.34 acres.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then R3 would cut that in half, and you'd have like 0.2
lots.
1.52, whatever the math is.
Yes, ma'am.
Lots. So it's teeny tiny lots where you could build two houses 10 feet from each other, right?
I think it's a R3, it's 10 feet off the side property line, so it would be 20 feet between.
Oh, 20. Okay, I was thinking it was only like 5 feet from the property line, so then maybe only 10.
Yeah, ma'am.
They're 20 feet apart.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Again, with this, I think that there's a line that has to be drawn where you say this far and no further, and what we have here is a comprehensive plan that's the old one and the new one that both have this Sweetgrass Basket overlay and both have this community conservation with a commitment to preserving kind of a character. And I think just because, one end of the street has gone this direction, I think It doesn't mean that it has to happen for the remainder of the street, or, you know, where do you draw the line? If that street goes, then what about Gulf Street, or what about the street next to it? I think it all goes, and then it just destroys a community. So I will not be in favor of this. Is there any further discussion?
Madam Chairman, I would just suggest that you're looking at both ends of the street, not just one. And having looked at what was out there previously and the conditions that were there previously, it has been substantially improved. There's currently a manufactured house on this lot, still on the trailer that it was brought in with. So I would suggest that we are substantially improving the area. And I would remind you that how close this area is to our 6 mile facility and all the noise and smell and everything else that's there, and the area has been substantially improved. We are making an improvement by doing what we've been doing for several years to the property. And if you go look at it and look at both ends of the street, you can see it's been substantially improved, and I will continue to vote for the motion.
All right. Is there any further discussion? No. All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? No.
Nope. No.
All right. The recommendation to full council is, oh, we don't have, wait. Denial. Recommendation for denial. Okay. On to item C.
Okay, this is a request to amend the Gregory Ferry Landing PD to do a couple of things. First is to reduce the amount of approved commercial square footage and to increase the allowable density from 12 units to 12.18 units per acre. And the purpose for that is to increase an additional 42 multifamily units that would be utilized for workforce housing in its entirety. And so the current zoning is PDMUSU, which is actually a district we don't have anymore, but it's a mixed-use PD. This was originally improved in 2006 with an impact assessment. So we had a PD, and then we had the impact assessment approved in 2006. And you can see the property there off of Gregory Ferry and Winnowing Way, where the green star is. So it was originally approved in 2006 to allow for the mixed use, which would be comprised of 240 multifamily units and almost 40,000 square feet of commercial space. It was to include office and business and retail. There was a subsequent amendment in 2009, which incorporated three additional parcels into the entire PD. And you can see all of the gray there is actually the PD. So three additional parcels came in 2009, and what that did was add an additional 45,000 square feet of commercial space. So as it stands today, you're allowed to have 240 multifamily units and 85,000 of commercial space. The proposal before you today is to amend the PD to do, first, reduce the commercial square footage from 85,000 to 62,000, so there would be a reduction of commercial by 23,000 square feet. Increase the amount of density allowed, which is 12 units an acre, to 12.18 units an acre. And then to amend the associated plan development map. So we have a text amendment, and then we have the map amendment.
All right.
And you can see there the height for this area is 50 feet. There are no other modifications to the PD being requested at this time. As I mentioned, when it was originally approved in 06, there was an associated impact assessment. They are not required to update their impact assessment, primarily because their impact assessment includes a trip generation table. And so when it was approved, the trip generation table had this maximum threshold of trips. So no matter what they did with their permitted uses, as long as they didn't exceed that threshold of trips, they were fine. What's before you today will actually reduce the number of overall trips. And so what they did was, typically we do this with, I think, Central Mount Pleasant too. Whenever they do an amendment, they don't necessarily amend their entire impact assessment. They amend their trip generation table, and then the town's transportation department looks at it and approves it. And so the overall increase of 42 multifamily units doesn't in and of itself require an impact assessment. What would necessitate one perhaps would be those trips. But they did submit their trips to our transportation department. And you can see what's approved now The total new primary trips was 5,416. And by reducing the commercial square footage and adding those 42 multifamily workforce housing units, there's a total new primary trip of 4,902. So there's an overall 10% decrease in that threshold. So there was no reason or requirement for them to update their impact assessment, only to amend the PD to allow those additional workforce housing units. The workforce housing units would consist of 21 one and two bedrooms, 21 one bedroom, 21 two bedroom. They would be priced to meet HUD's defined 80% area median income, so you have to meet certain requirements to be workforce housing units. And the developer has submitted a document of covenants and restrictions that our legal department has looked over. And what that would do is protect those workforce housing units in perpetuity with a 75-year deed restriction on them.
Nice.
Which is much longer than any deed restrictions we currently have on any of our workforce housing units. And this is the aerial of the site development. On 17 here, Planning Commission did unanimously recommend approval. They did have one condition, and that was that there would be a CARTA bus shelter. There is a CARTA stop. It's circled here on Highway 17, but there's no shelter. There's no bench or anything. And so the developer did agree to work with CARTA to put in a bus shelter bench for the workforce housing units. And this does comply with our comprehensive plan. Both our current comprehensive plan and our draft comprehensive plan encourages mixed use in this area. It encourages workforce housing, a variety of housing that's offered. It's called life cycle housing. And so this is all consistent with our zoning and our current comprehensive plan. So I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Are there any questions from the committee? Yes, Mr. Chapman.
In the impact assessment, there is a suggestion that the town's project to connect US 17 and SC 41 through Gregory Ferry Landing is not assumed to be complete. Well, obviously the project's not complete, but And I don't mean this in any way to denigrate what we're trying to do with workforce housing. There are, or has been a suggestion that instead of having the intersection of 41 with 17, that the 41 be skirted over to Winnowing Way, so the intersection is actually with directly across from say again?
Porsche's Bluff.
Yeah, Porsche Bluff. Does this project in any way impact that possibility? Because I think that's probably the best location for that intersection rather than an overpass rather than at 41 and 17.
So they have allowed for, is it 90-foot right-of-way? 90-foot right-of-way. So they've been anticipating that, Mr. Chapman, and they have allowed for the 90-foot right-of-way there. And so if for some reason that project does not occur on this route, they could perhaps, you know, move it up. But they have allowed for that extra right-of-way should that improvement happen.
Okay. My second question is on the trip generation tables.
Mm-hmm.
The trip generation rate was suggested for condominiums as opposed to townhouses, which I think these are. I believe they're townhouses, which is a good thing. Does that make any difference in the trip generation rates? I know in the trip generation tables, there is a difference between condominium and townhouse. So this may be a question for the consultants for the developer, but I'm wondering if anybody else caught that.
Well, Mr. Woody can speak to that as well, but these are actually proposed to be multifamily. They're not townhouses.
Okay, because the pictures look like townhouses, and that's what was in the newspaper, that they were going to be townhouses.
Oftentimes how things look as opposed to how they're owned and subdivided and managed, differ. So what we see You know, you even have folks now marketing and advertising townhome-looking apartment buildings. So, I mean, it's a matter of the nomenclature versus the ownership and how they're actually...
So they're definitely not townhouses.
We have Mr. Berry here. Mr. Berry, would you answer that question?
Tony Berry, 39 Waterway Island Drive. The picture in the paper did not come from us, and the proposal is to build 42 condominiums, 21 one-bedrooms and 21 two-bedrooms, and pending our approvals, those plans and all would be submitted shortly thereafter.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I apologize, but I'd rather get it off the table right away rather than wait.
No worries.
Thank you. I thought there were townhouses, too.
All right, is there any further discussion? Do we have a motion?
I would just like to commend everybody who worked on this. This is so impressive. I'm sorry that I wasn't a part of it. I just get to approve something, but good job. This is very impressive.
It is. Much needed.
Much needed,
absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. And thank you to Mr. Berry and Housing for All Mount Pleasant. And I think that the 75-year deed restriction is a huge, huge thing, because the 10 years, I mean, you saw on the previous slide, the other ones in town are 10 years and then 10 and done. That's nothing in the life of affordable housing. So do we have a motion to for full council?
So moved.
Second.
All right, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. On item D.
So this is a request to rezone two parcels from R1 low density residential district to CC community conservation district. And they are located, as you can see from the aerial up here, across from Wando High School on the Front Edge Road. It's Marginal Road. And it's actually two parcels. And you can kind of see the stars over the line. So there's a front parcel and a back parcel. And those are both 0.20 acres. So combined, they would be 0.40 acres. So back in 2017, there was a manufactured home on the rear parcel. And it was there for quite some time. I think this was annexed in 2004. So this was one of those properties that we talked about on the first agenda item that it annexed in automatically, and they didn't request another zoning, and so they were assigned what the comprehensive plan called for. And the comprehensive plan called for low-density residential district, which assigned them R1. And the R1 zoning district does not allow manufactured homes. But when it came in, it was legally established on a county piece of property. It came in, was zoned R1. The mobile home was no longer allowed in the R1, but it could remain. Well, they removed it in 2017 because they wanted to replace it and put a newer home there. And it came to their attention that they couldn't do that under the current R1 zoning in the town. And so what they would request to do is, this is an old aerial when the mobile home was there. And so what they're requesting is to rezone to CC, community conservation, which does allow by right manufactured homes. And the applicant sent in quite a few images of this whole area. And this whole area, although it is zoned R1, it's predominantly manufactured homes. And so I think looking back over previous maps, when this came in, the area maybe should have been assigned the CC zoning, because that was more consistent with the development patterns in this area and the development itself, the lot sizes and those sorts of things. But it was assigned R1, so all these manufactured homes you see currently are not permitted anymore. And so if they were to remove them, they would have to go through the same process and rezone. And so these are just some of the homes in the area. And so they're not requesting to subdivide or do anything. The lot's already subdivided. There's an access easement that goes to that back property. They just want to replace what was there with a newer manufactured home in 2017. So I'm happy to answer questions if you have them.
All right. Committee, is there any questions?
No, ma'am. You answered my question about the access easement, because mm-hmm. that was my concern, how you get to the back lot.
Yeah.
I'll move for approval, Madam Chairman.
All right. Is there a second?
I second.
All right. Is there any further discussion?
I have a question. What other use in this community conservation zoning could they do with that property? Because everything around it is R1, and then you just have that one piece.
Well, it's single-family residential. So CC and R1 are very similar in lot size. They both require 12,500 square feet. Actually, no, I think R1 is 10,000. So CC actually requires a larger lot size. But under the R1, this lot, these lots do not meet the R1 zoning. So they're not going to meet the CC zoning either. So CC and R1 are both single family residents. Really the primary difference in use is that the community conservation allows a manufactured home and the R1 district does not. So, okay.
Mm-hmm. Any further discussion? All those in favor? Aye.
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 Aye. All right, motion passes unanimously.
All right, the last item that came from December's Planning Commission is a text amendment. And staff spent quite a few months on this. It came up over, we had a couple of issues come up, different proposals that came before staff, and it made us aware of some language ambiguity in our zoning ordinance that we felt like needed to be clarified. And so when we first started this discussion with Planning Commission, our goal was to do a couple things. One was the way the language was written in the current zoning ordinance, it talks about the critical line buffer and how it allows for a vision corridor. So just to give you some context, if you have a critical line buffer, you're allowed to do a 33% vision corridor to allow you a view from your house.
Okay.
So that, you know, many people purchase these lots so that they can have that view. So the way the language is currently written, it says you can have a view from your house. And so it was sort of implied that it only applied to residences or residential uses. What we originally were going to do under direction from Planning Commission was to sort of make that crystal clear that this was only going to apply to residential uses. Well, once we started going through the process, we realized, well, we have properties that could be commercial, they could be HOA property, and so the direction we got after a few meetings with Planning Commission was that this shouldn't just apply to residential properties, this should apply to any property that has a critical line buffer. So if you have a property that has a critical line buffer and you can meet all the requirements in our ordinance, you can have a vision, you can establish a vision corridor. So that's the first thing we did. The second thing we did was better define how that 33% was measured, because oftentimes, if you can imagine a critical line buffer, it's not a straight, pretty line. It's sort of messy, and so, and Eddie oftentimes has to review these, and so we talked about an easier way to make it measurable so that he can approve these without making it too burdensome. And so that was the second thing we did. And then we also, we originally intended, at the direction of Planning Commission, to make it clear that if I have a piece of property, but there's, say, an HOA property or another piece of property in between my parcel and the marsh, I could clear, for the purposes of my vision corridor, on the adjoining property owner. So currently, you couldn't necessarily do that, but the language wasn't clear. And so we originally thought we need to make it clear that you can't clear a vision corridor on an adjoining property for your benefit. Well, after discussing it with the Planning Commission and having public input, they decided to, so we've kind of done a 180 on all of these items. So at first we were going to make it just residential, and second we were just going to make it for the purposes of our own property and our own benefit. The way it's currently before you now at the direction of Planning Commission is if I have my property, the adjacent property owner's consent, and they have to provide written consent, and they have to understand that they're giving up a portion of their vision corridor, it can be cleared, or a portion of it can be cleared for my benefit. So that's the third thing that this did. And so basically, number one, all of the text that's removed has strike through, and then the new text is underlined and bold. So this strike-through text actually did not get deleted, it just got moved. And so, number one, we talk about the vision corridor can be established on properties where there is a critical line buffer established. So if you have a critical line buffer, you can have a vision corridor if you meet all of our other requirements. Then we talk about that it can't exceed more than one-third of the square footage of the total critical line area buffer. So here's where we get into the how it can be measured and those sorts of things. But another thing that brought this up, and I'm happy to discuss this further because I know this is getting really confusing, but the other thing that we wanted to make clear when we first started this process was we had some folks want to, because typically how it had been interpreted was, if I have a 33% vision corridor, it's 33%. Well, we had some folks come in and they wanted to do, say, 10-foot and 5-foot and break it up. And we felt like that wasn't the intent of the ordinance, that the intent of the ordinance was to keep it in one single unbroken portion. However, once we started working on that and we brought that draft text to the Planning Commission and we had public input, that changed as well. And we were directed to, you know what, it may not be such a bad thing to break the vision corridor up so long as you don't do it no less than 25 feet in width. So that's the other change to this ordinance. It still allows a 33% vision corridor, and it's not to be unbroken unless it can be broken up no less than 25 feet in width, and you can't overall exceed that 33% on your property. So those are the main things that this ordinance does. The last thing it does, and it was really the intent of the current ordinance, but it wasn't clear, is that when you establish a vision corridor, it's supposed to be delineated on a plat and recorded. That way, you don't have somebody coming in 3, 4, 5 years later, and they clear another portion. And so it gets very difficult to track and to keep track of. And so what we wanted to make clear was, okay, you can come in, you can establish your vision corridor, staff approves it, it's delineated on a plat, you get it recorded. However, if you want to come in 4 or 5 years and you want to change it, then that has to be approved. And then you have to get that new vision corridor delineated on a plat and recorded. And then you have to reinstate the previous vision corridor based on how our ordinance is written. So I know that was a lot of information and a little bit confusing. We've been working on this for about 3 or 4 months through discussions and such with Planning Commission, and it really did take a complete turn as to how we thought we were going to move forward. But this is what we're presenting to you today with these changes. So.
Are there any questions from the committee? I have a question.
Okay.
So in this change over from viewing it as a horizontal line corridor to now 33% of the square footage, So this is basically clear cutting of what, trees and bushes to basically make a view for yourself? That's kind of what it is, right? And so I guess my question is 33% of square footage could potentially be a greater amount of cutting. Could it be a greater amount of cutting than if it was just 33% of the length of the critical line buffer? Or is there a way to dual cap it so that, you know, because someone could cut 50, like maybe if it goes in deeper or something like that, if we're just measuring from a line this way, I guess that's my question.
Well, I'll answer your first one when you talked about, can it be clear cut? So the ordinance already says, we're not changing that. It says within the vision corridor, trees of a protected size shall not be removed. Smaller trees may be pruned or cut with hand tools, but the stump must remain in place. Grasses, shrubs, and other small vegetation may be appropriately pruned and trimmed, but not removed at the root. So it's pretty clear on what you can do in the vision corridor. It's not a free-for-all clear cutting. And it's something that does get reviewed by our staff and approved before they can move forward with it. As for how it is measured, that's not really my area of expertise. I would have to turn it over to our expert with that, and I don't... Jeff, do you want to give Eddie jumps up?
Yeah, who is our expert?
Eddie. Oh, it's, yeah.
Okay. Yes. So I just want to try to understand the change from 33% from the old 33% square footage versus a linear measure of the vision corridor.
Yeah, well, in the end, it'll be the same. It's just, most of these lots are not all of the lots are regular shapes. So sometimes you have critical line that may be the rear and the side. or you may have a long peninsula or something weird. So it becomes difficult to try to, I mean, when you measure, you know, the outside, the critical line itself, and you measure the inside line, the buffer line, you know, it's two very different linear footages at times. So it was just, you know, the square footage, you know, that just seemed to be the better way to measure it, because that's a consistent, you know, if you did have a nice regular rectangular lot, then that's easy to figure out what that is. But when you have these circuitous, you know, critical line measurements, and again, the critical line measurement and the inside buffer line measurement linear footage wise may be very different numbers. So it just seemed like the square footage was the easier way. You know, that's a consistent measurable on regardless of what shape the lot is. But at the end of the day, you should still be getting the same amount of vision corridor, so it wouldn't be a net gain or loss in that regard versus the way it was written previously.
Okay.
But it's just, that
was my question. It's just, was it going to be more or less?
No, it should be the same.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions from committee? Ms. Hyatt?
So it's 33% of the total lot?
Yes, ma'am.
So a third of the lot. Mm-hmm. Or linear, it's not linear feet, it's the total square footage of the lot.
Of the buffer, not the lot.
Okay, I was going to be like, whoa, and, third.
And just for clarification, that 33%, that's what our current ordinance allows. Mm-hmm. What we are just doing is clarifying that it could be broken up, no less than 25 feet, and we're clarifying how it can be measured.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Is there any further discussion from, do we have a motion for full council?
I make a motion.
Second.
All right. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. Moving on to item four, this was a discussion that I believe came out of Education Committee. Was that? Yeah. Was that correct? Yes. So this possible rezoning of school properties. This was in part to harmonize, because the school properties are all zoned, as you can see, very, very different things. So there's a thought of harmony with that, and then also of impacting these cell towers being placed on school properties by looking at a rezoning of school property. So Jeff, please.
Sure. Thank you. Good morning. Yes, this relates to the question of cell tower possibilities on the school properties. And this is the same presentation that was given to the Education Committee last month. There are two distinctions. If you can co-locate or add communications equipment to an existing structure, building, tower, whatever's there. So that's already allowed in the zoning code. And so conceivably, you wouldn't get a monopole or a tall tower individually, but communications equipment could be placed on an existing structure as long as it does not increase the height by more than 30 feet. So we want to make it clear that you can still get such facilities located on school properties as they're zoned today, on all properties. And then depending on the zoning district in terms of establishing a new tower, the use under light industrial LI is a conditional use. So this is where staff would be able to review and approve a new tower, provided it met all the conditions otherwise established in the code. There are no school properties zoned this way. So light industrial isn't one that we deal with. However, in the AB2, PI1, and PI2, public institutional, they're a special exception. And so we provide for you, and then those go to Board of Zoning Appeals for review. This was generated by questions about a potential tower at Moultrie Middle. It is zoned AB. Lucy Beckham is zoned PI1. And what happens under that district is that you may establish a tower, but it needs to be the primary facility. The primary use is for safety or utility use. So commercial towers for private use are not allowed on PI1 zone properties. And then we run through again, and their planned development districts, you don't have a typical zoning designation. You don't have a district. So you have a variety of different schools with different allowances. And so again, here's the summary table where Again, co-location is permitted in all zoning districts on an existing structure or facility, but this is the array of zoning and the requirements that you can follow, would have to follow for the 13 schools located within the town. So the question was whether or not the town should proactively initiate a zoning change to make all of these consistent and deal with the possibility of communications towers, cell towers at school sites. And with that, I'll turn it back to Madam Chairman.
All right. Does anyone have any questions for Mr.
Well, Ola? Madam Chairman, the first question I have is, and I think the same thing came up in the legal planning and legal and police committee. When we get something on our agenda that says discussion of, it would be very helpful to know, because it would have been nice to have seen this before the presentation, it would be helpful to know, number one, where it came from. Obviously, this one came from the education committee. It may have come from a member of council who had a interest in or a constituent and said him something. But it would be very helpful to me to have the information about why we're discussing it, where it came from, who put it on our agenda, or who requested it be on our agenda, and then what outcome is anticipated. So other than that, I don't have any way to discuss this other than what I just saw.
So I believe this came out of Education Committee with Mr. Rambo making the suggestion, because we were looking at the issue of the cell towers and potentially going on to Moultrie Middle with the AB zoning. And then there was a greater discussion as we looked at all the variety of zonings on there over whether or not it made sense to have more harmony among our schools within the town and have a zoning that was uniform to all of them. I don't know if the school district has weighed in at all on their thoughts on this. Have we heard anything from the school district?
No, we haven't until we got further direction about whether council was interested in actually pursuing this. We haven't communicated with the schools, exactly. But we can.
Okay.
Well, it seems that the zoning districts make more sense rather than them being a blanket for all the schools for where they're located. What's, you know, a neighborhood school or whether they're on the highway, you know, the underlying zoning. I don't see why they should all be the same. And maybe there's some other way to address this rather than assign them all the exact same zoning.
Just a question. But zoning them all, changing their zoning, it's still going to make them open for school.
Co-location.
Right. Right. So that's not changing anything.
Unless you did other changes to the text of the ordinance.
Okay.
So maybe that's where Ms. Hyatt's going, or is there a different mechanism that you would want to look at versus flat changing the zoning district?
And your concern is just to be proactive and maybe do something before the issue actually arises?
Yes, I think that was the concern of the education committee was to take a look at, I think particularly it was Moultrie Middle was the school in particular that was facing the putting of a monopole up on the property, and coming. But there has not been anything done thus far. No application has been filed. There's nothing before BOZA. There's nothing before the town at this point in time on this issue.
On that particular one, no.
Are these zonings of R1, R2? I mean, is a school use a permitted use under that, under the zonings? So under all these zonings, school usage is permitted?
A special exception?
It's a special exception, okay.
So that has to go to BOZA.
But there's already
for
gone.
Review, but.
Yeah, well, it's already done.
The idea that school would be located there and it makes sense has been dealt with. Now you're dealing with addition of a use or an activity on the property, and is that appropriate or not? Also depends on size of sites. I mean, in order to meet the other standards and requirements and setbacks and those kinds of things, a small site, and depending what, you know, where the school property and what you have to work with, it may be a non-starter in any case. You just can't do it to create a standalone. But we'd have to go and you'd have to look at every single school site and figure that kind of thing out.
Okay. So the only school where really it's an issue is Moultrie Middle with the AB zoning, because with all the other ones, it's co-location or special or only, or it's co-location with a special exception for public safety use, which would not allow a commercial.
Right.
So I think that then we could narrow the, I mean, this is just a discussion at this point, but we can narrow the discussion maybe to Moultrie Middle. I don't know how the committee feels about that, or if they even view this as a concern, because I know that there's a large there's a contingent of constituents who are very concerned about a 5G or a cell tower going in at a public middle school.
Madam Chairman, I would like to hear from the school district before we do anything, because they're another elected body from us. This may be a non-issue. It just may be something that's out there as a possibility, but it would be helpful for me to hear from the school district before I do anything, any kind of a vote.
I'm comfortable with that. Can we, does everyone feel comfortable with that? Do we ask the school district to
focusing on
to
just
in?
Moultrie at this point?
I think focusing on Moultrie mm-hmm. makes sense.
We can follow up with them.
All right, great. Moving on to item number 5 on the agenda, discuss potential revisions to ordinance provisions which deal with non-conforming properties. This was placed on the agenda by Mr. Rambo, and he spoke on it at public comment. Mr. Oma?
Yes, thank you. The whole issue of non-conformities, and like some other similar terms in the world of planning and zoning, there's a lot of confusion oftentimes about what it really is. You often hear things like a taking. Is this a taking if you change the zoning? Is this spot zoning? Well, nonconformities and nonconforming uses are a similar one to that, and it's way more complicated than kind of a quick and easy answer. So what we put together for you is something that we hope at least lays the framework, and then you can figure out where you want to go in terms of discussion. And so obviously what happens is council adopts a change in regulations, and it becomes more restrictive than maybe what was allowed before. Michelle just did the one that the zoning doesn't allow a manufactured home in that district anymore, whereas it might have in the past. So the use or activity that was on the property is no longer deemed acceptable or shouldn't be allowed if you make changes like removing uses, increasing buffers. And some of these are dimensional, and they may be not as dramatic, like, oh, my buffer or my setback used to be 10 feet, and now it's 12. You may or may not notice it. Mostly it's things that are major, like building heights or the uses, where an entire use is no longer allowed in that zoning district after the new ordinance takes effect. And there's confusion even where, well, I can do this no matter what. And the general term that we hear a lot about is called grandfathering. You don't get that protection if that use that was there was illegal to begin with. So oftentimes people say that this applies to me, and it's like, no, you shouldn't have begun. You didn't follow the requirements as they existed even at the time. We're not talking about those. We're talking about existing legal uses. Zoning isn't retroactive. You don't go back and undermine what the zoning is. So what you do is consider ways to grandfather uses to allow them to continue to remain with certain limitations. That status runs with the land. So it's not that you give nonconformity to one property owner and then somebody new purchases the land and they no longer get to utilize the nonconforming provisions. And then the whole notion of, you know, what you're doing here is that you expect a nonconforming use eventually to go away. And uses and activities should be meeting today's present ordinances. Otherwise, why would you change the ordinance to begin with? So there are different types of nonconforming situations. So generally you hear nonconformities, but these can vary in terms of a use, the site itself. So maybe the layout of the property. You had a rezoning recently, residential turned to office. Will it be able to meet all the site requirements? The lot, so maybe the lot dimensions change and it can no longer meet the new zoning code requirements, or the structure itself, the physical improvement on the land. And it's the property owner's responsibility
to prove the validity of when we have an issue and they say, well, I'm nonconforming, they have to prove that they are nonconforming. It's not up to local government to go and figure all of that out. So they have to provide evidence. And different ways that communities then handle nonconformities, you allow it to continue and you allow somebody to maintain the property, paint it, improve it, minor modifications and changes, because you don't want it going in a negative direction and going into disrepair. So you allow it to remain that way so you can keep going without intensifying. You require conformity later on if somebody abandons the use, ceases using it for that, and for a certain period of time. And you can look at zoning ordinances. That's a local decision. Typically, it's about 180 days, 6 months. You require conformity if a proposed set of improvements will exceed a certain amount. So yeah, you're nonconforming, you want to make a number of changes and improvements. You can do that, but you need to bring that nonconforming situation into compliance with today's standards and zoning regulations, and that would be allowed. And the most aggressive is communities that would actually say, this is a use that we definitely do not want in our community. And you can actually amortize that use out of existence over a certain period of time, allowing them to recoup, say, investment, the economic investment in the property. We're not talking about that, but communities do that. And usually that's for uses that are truly noxious or obnoxious, with, you know, in neighborhoods. State law in South Carolina gives you and gives us the authority to deal with this topic. So it lays out, you know, the different mechanisms you can provide for this, and then you move then to your local zoning ordinance, and our ordinance covers this topic. So we're describing what a nonconformity is, but you're actually in your code, number two, A1, excuse me, says that if it becomes nonconforming, you're saying that that's detrimental to the future of the community. And so you've established that that use needs to meet all of these different provisions in the long term. And so our ordinance divides it out into two categories, lots, structures and uses, and allows like ongoing maintenance, that cessation or abandonment for a certain period of time. And if you improve more than 50% of the value, that's the trigger that requires somebody to meet today's new zoning district or overlay provisions or whatever they are. And so we just run through a few things, say dealing with lots. You may have two non-conforming lots, you own both of those. There is a way that you could combine those and meet today's newer standards. So if the lot size went up and I have two small lots and I could combine them and meet the larger new standard, you have to do that first. Or you can reduce or not meet certain standards by no more than 20%. And if you got to go more than 20%, say on a width or a dimension or a yard or a setback, that goes to Board of Zoning Appeals. So it could be more than 20%. So those are lots. Structures and uses, ordinary repairs and maintenance can be done. And then that trigger that we mentioned, if you are going to improve it more than half of its reasonable replacement value, you now need to bring it up into conformance with all requirements of the code. You can't change a non-conforming use from one to another. And here's the abandonment provision here. If it's vacant for 12 months in a year or 18 total months in a two-year period, so there's a time provision that we have to account for. You would be then declared abandoned, and you can't reestablish that use unless you meet today's requirements. And damaged structures, and this is the one that gets the most discussion, the what-if scenario. What if this building were damaged or destroyed more than 50% of its value? Do I really need to then, you know, can I just stay and replace it, or can I get a variance to stay there or whatever? This is one area, at least, where we have a lot of dialogue about it. You can make some other adjustments and extend portions of the building, but there are limitations on that when you make those improvements. And if you had a vested right and you were already in play, then a change in the regulations allows you to maintain that vested right. And then there's even more of a twist if you're in a historic district. You may not meet a dimension, a standard, but that's okay because it may meet the historic character of that area and might not meet today's modern standards of rectangles and square dimensions or easy to measure dimensions. So with that sort of basic, there you go. It's your turn now. That was the softball pitch.
Thank you so much for that presentation, Mr. Alma. I'd like to open it up to the committee for discussion. Any thoughts on this? I think that the reason this was raised was, as we were discussing the building heights plan and lowering heights, there was a concern about creating more non-conforming properties. And I think that the word, kind of the question I feel like came from staff was, well, if you're going to let these non-conforming properties exist, you know, why even have, you know, why even do this, you know, kind of that was kind of the impression I got. But I think that there was this sense of we want to allow people to keep what they have, even for because there's so few properties that would be considered non-conforming in these zones. So I think that was where this discussion of revisions to the ordinance, which would allow those buildings that maybe say have 80 feet in a zone that we're going to reduce it to 65 feet, should a disaster happen, they would be able to rebuild their property. So I think that was where this discussion came from, Mr. Chapman. So I don't
know. Well, again, it would have been helpful to have that information in advance, so I might have been able to discuss. I have no comment.
All right. Ms. Corley, do you have any thoughts?
Is there an action that we're supposed to take from this, or is it just a informational sort of a comment?
I think that there is potential action that we could ask staff to look at doing at revising the ordinance if we want to. But that doesn't necessarily have to
be in conjunction with other ordinance changes. Just keeping this in mind when you consider changes to building height, for instance, you will see there were changes to the zoning that were made along Ben Sawyer. Last year in terms of the overlay, the corridor overlay, and the Planning Commission gets a dozen or more. 18 properties have come in together and asking to be reinstated back to the way the overlay, because their use as residential is no longer allowed on their properties. And so this has a real effect on property owners as they deal with ownership or the future financing. Sometimes, you know, it gets to be a problematic for folks. So you will be seeing real live example of making a change and then the implications of that on existing properties, and that now we'll have a situation we have to deal with making a decision on what to do with those particular properties. It's not theoretical.
So we already have issues with this, with that change in the overlay. So our height discussion is not really
not
triggering
without
this alone.
You're right.
And just granting variances, that's not enough to solve it. We should have an ordinance that really covers the blanket.
I mean, a variance that meets other certain standards and legal requirements. The number one meaning, well, it's that I can't otherwise do this on my property. That's a hard standard, you know, to pass. And it can't be an economic one. Well, I'd be better off if I could rebuild my building back at this four stories. I mean, you're now only letting it be three. The economic aspect of it is not something that the Board of Zoning Appeals is supposed to be dealing with. So you're kind of limited in figuring it out, except under these provisions. And then you could craft something perhaps that fits what it is we want to do.
What I see is the tension here is that as we move towards rezoning or changing building heights, we are making a statement about how we feel the town should look and how we feel the town should be. And the tension comes in that there are properties that don't conform with that vision for the town. And if we make these changes and maintain our ordinances as is, the eventual goal would be that these properties would eventually come into compliance over time through redevelopment or through abandonment of use or through a natural disaster. So the question that we have to consider as a committee is, do we want to undo that and say we are okay with properties that are going to be non-conforming, and we're going to allow them to continue to be non-conforming in perpetuity simply because they built a building under an old height or under an old zoning, or and we're going to continue to allow this non-conforming use in perpetuity. So I think we have to kind of balance, you know, and if we do allow that, then are we really getting the vision that we want for the town long term? So that's the question I feel like we're facing. I feel for the property owners who have the existing properties and they want to maintain what they have. But if we as a council are moving the town in a different direction, or moving the town in a, you know, the coastal community sort of direction, how do we balance that? So I think that's something that we need to think about.
And that moving in that direction will definitely need David and others' help as you move into the legal, truly the legal versus the planning and zoning aspects of this. I don't know that we've seen ordinances that say you can be non-conforming forever. Right. You're sort of contradicting the whole purpose. But so we'd have to look at those kinds of things.
I would just like to add, 12, I think it's 12 o'clock today, we have a presentation on our comprehensive plan, which is what you're talking about. So I would suggest we hold off any further discussion until that comes up, because there are lots of things in that comprehensive plan to talk about how we want our community to be. And that's the reason we need to get past that and pass the comprehensive plan with whatever changes we want to make.
Yeah, that was going to be my question, too.
All right. Well, great. Well, then why don't we table this discussion for now, and if we need to bring it up next month, depending on what happens with our next meetings, we can. Item number 6 on the agenda.
This is a request from Legacy Patriots Point, LLC, for a one-year extension of vested rights. This is provided for in the ordinance. Here's the property located at Patriots Point and Harry Hallman Boulevard on the corner. And they have been working on this project for a number of years. We have some background in history that's truly takes you back to the whole vested right and permitting extensions that the legislature put into effect at one point in time. But for this project, this property was vested and began running January 1 until December 31st. Last year, they asked for an extension until December 31st of 2019, and they have now applied for, as allowed, a second one-year extension for their vested rights. One of the things that we have to look at is whether or not an ordinance change that occurred since that vested right may preclude this from happening. And the only one that we've adopted that could have had anything to do with it were dealing with replacement trees when we dealt with gathering spaces and parks, and it's not applicable to this. So under the ordinance, these folks are guaranteed that they should receive the one-year extension for vested rights.
Do we have a motion?
I'll move for discussion.
Do we have a second? I'll second it. So this is basically on the previous slide, it said the state law kind of requires these extensions, right? There's five mandatory one-year extensions. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So this is coming before us, but basically it's mandatory under state law.
Right, and under our ordinance.
Okay. Okay.
They get five, not two. Five?
They get five mandatory one-year extensions. Yeah.
Right. And we're on an initial, it's an initial two-year vesting, and then 5 1-year extensions can be requested.
Okay.
If an ordinance has changed that would no longer permit them, then they're not guaranteed that extension.
But we don't have that.
So they have to hustle to get it built.
Okay.
Is that moved to approve?
All right. So there's a motion to approve. There's a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. A motion passes unanimously. Item number 7 is the Settlement Communities Task Force. So this was approved at council, and so I asked for this to be on the agenda here to discuss how the application process and set up a sort of a timeline for how we can get this organized, how we can do outreach into the communities to ensure that the leadership of every community is represented on this task force and understands the purpose of the task force, which is to protect and preserve the historic communities, whether or not they are in the town or whether or not they are in the county. So, Mr. Alma?
I don't have any additional to add at this point.
Was there a draft application that was completed, or was there no?
No.
Okay. Okay.
So it's more for discussion. We can follow up with more detail on moving forward, but
I thought that there was going to be, we had discussed looking at some of the existing applications for boards and commissions and maybe putting together some kind of draft application. Could we move forward in that direction with doing something like along those lines? I think that would be good. Is there any other,
Again, Madam Chairman, if we'd had some more detailed information about why this is back on the agenda, it would have been helpful and maybe folk encourage some more discussion. But without it, I think it's a great idea, but we need the information in advance to give us a reason to discuss it.
All right. Ms. Corley, Ms. Hyatt, do you have anything?
Mm-hmm. Nope.
All right. Well, then, if you could please bring back next month sort of the draft so that we can move forward, that would be greatly appreciated. All right. Item number 7 is done. The next item on the agenda is to adjourn, so we stand adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.